So someone asked me during one of the breaks about, they just brought up that they had been feeling some vulnerability, and then a concern came up that in that kind of state, might they maybe be taken advantage of, or and it's true that we develop certain patterns to protect ourselves. Although sometimes those patterns, sometimes they are appropriate, sometimes they're not. But there might be that kind of concern. And kind of a story came to mind, so maybe this might answer that question, or but it's kind of an amusing story. So I'll call this story my encounter with two very drunk guys while practicing walking meditation. And a couple of years ago, I did a self-retreat at home where I just made up a schedule of sitting and walking, and I didn't really have a place to walk inside. So I, as part of my schedule in the evening, it was January, I would go out for, I'd walk about 5 kilometers, take me about an hour. And I thought, oh, well, why don't I practice metta, meditation and compassion, so offer good wishes to just silently to those that I pass by along my walk. So I go out this one evening, and it's a cold January dark night. It had snowed earlier, but then it had kind of gotten icy and a bit messy. And part of my route, I'd go along Feltham. So I was kind of on this dark kind of area of Feltham, and I'm two guys are approaching me. And so it's just them and myself. And I kind of feel like a little uncomfortable because I'm not sure, oh, should I step off the sidewalk onto kind of the icy spots there to let them pass, or just sort of make our way past each other. And I just decided to kind of stay in the middle, so I'd walk in between them. And they were dressed kind of like maybe kind of like construction worker type clothes. And so I'm approaching, and I'm feeling just a little nervous because I'm not sure, are they going to make some room for me to walk by? And I notice one of the guys who'd be over here as I'm approaching, he raises his right hand. He's got a mitt on or something. I have gloves on, like this. And it's a little odd. And then I kind of figure out, I'm quite close as we're approaching, that he wants to high five. So I raise my hand, and we kind of high five as we go by. So, well, that's cool, you know. However, then the other guy kind of turns, and since I've kind of made contact with him, he bellows out, "Hey, Johnny Cash!" And I kind of look over my shoulder, and a little confusion arises in my mind state. And then he says, so I must have slowed down a little, and then he starts walking towards me, and he says, "Hey, Johnny Cash, give me a hug." And I'm not sure. I kind of have to think fast at this point. But two things were clear. I didn't want to give this guy a hug. And I didn't want to kind of turn my back to these guys either, because I felt some threat, whether warranted or not, but that was my feeling. So I didn't want to kind of take off or turn my back. So I kind of just stood there, and my arm kind of went out, almost felt like Tai Chi, and kind of met his chest, and I said one word. So the word was no. And as soon as that happened, I turned and started walking away. And then I'm not sure I can exactly repeat what he said, but it was something like, F you, Johnny Cash. which confirmed my theory about... Now, I didn't know on approaching that they were drunk, but as we had this little interaction, I could smell some fumes, and it was pretty clear. It did confirm my kind of theory that very drunk people are either your best friend or your enemy. It's kind of, there's not that much room in between. So here I am out for a walk trying to practice metta and compassion. And so then the question I asked myself was, well, was that compassionate action? And so it seemed to me, I think so. Because, well, I wanted to have compassion action for myself, and I knew my needs, and I think it was probably a reasonable message to them that maybe not everybody wanted to give them a hug. And who knows if I had thought, well, maybe it was a simple kind of encounter with some, drunk guys and that was the end of it. Or, maybe if I had said, oh, sure, let's hug, this rather large guy with his hands around me, well, maybe I would have lost my wallet, or who knows. That I don't know. But so anyway, there I was trying to practice compassion, and that was the result. And I would like to have said that I was totally calm and collected as I continued on my mindful walk, but I was a little agitated, sort of looking over my shoulder. I got home and I told June what happened, and her response was, well, I'm glad it wasn't me. So that's my little story. And so I guess my message is, being compassionate doesn't just mean doing whatever anyone asks of you. It can actually be very powerful as well. I was going through recently just some files and organizing some things, and I noticed a file folder of the first talk I'd given on the Sunday night sit. And it was in the fall, in October of 2010. I had just started the Community Dharma Leader Training Program and was, stretching myself, saying, okay, well, I'll put myself out there and start giving some talks on Sunday night and preparing talks. And then I looked, so this was a file folder with some notes from that first talk I gave, and I looked at the title and it said, Suffering, the End of Suffering, and Compassion. And so I just thought, this is a theme, looking at compassion from different ways, different perspectives that I do keep coming back to. So I said earlier that compassion is part of this group of four qualities. The friendliness or loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And then that compassion is defined sometimes as a quivering of the heart, kind of in a physical way, connected to the body, to feel with. And Thich Nhat Hanh has a little phrase he uses, that compassion is a verb. And I'd like to just talk about what compassion is not. And there's some things called near enemies. Some things that kind of look like compassion, but they're not compassion. And so pity would be the poor cousin of compassion. So with pity, we are we feel sorry for, but we're disconnected from the other. And probably disconnected from ourselves as well. Whereas compassion is to feel with. I would say another near enemy could be something like guilt. Guilt might arise and cause some kind of action that's based on guilt. And a far enemy is the opposite. So cruelty would be the opposite of compassion. And we think, that's so clearly different than compassion, so it'd be easy to differentiate. Although if we're in the midst of some kind of emotional storm, it might be hard to parse it apart. If there's feelings of ill will present in our actions, it might manifest as cruelty. I wanted to talk a little bit about the story of the historical Buddha. And many of you will be familiar with that, with his journey. He came from very comfortable background. He was a prince. He would have been headed to be the king of this kingdom. Comfortable life, but he decided to go on a search, a spiritual search. So he left the kingdom, gave all that up, and he was looking really for the end of suffering or something that was more lasting than these temporary pleasures that he was used to experiencing. So he was looking more deeply into the human condition. And he found a couple of teachers. He was made progress in their kind of teachings, but he didn't feel with those teachers that he had found the answer, that the depth of answer that he was looking for. And then he started an ascetic practice. It almost seemed like he was trying to sort of conquer suffering through suffering. But part of his practice was eating very little for long periods of time. And he became very, very thin and weak. So I want to pick up that story at that point. So he's reflecting on this and sitting by the banks of a river, probably near death from his ascetic practices. And a young girl comes by, sees this person suffering, and her name is Sujata. So I can imagine that she felt compassion for this suffering being, and she went and got a meal of milk, rice cooked in milk, and offered it to Siddhartha. And he had come to the point where he realized his path was not leading to the answer that he was looking for. And he accepted this gift, which came out of generosity, which came out of compassion. And then, as the story goes, that nourished him enough that contributed to him being strong enough to sit through on the night that he became enlightened. and realized the source of suffering and the ending of suffering. So now it gets kind of interesting, is that, so the Buddha comes out of this deep, deep experience in a state of bliss, and he reflects on what he has realized over a period of maybe a couple of weeks, and these deep truths of the cause of suffering, the ending of suffering, and he starts to think, well, it's kind of like, now what? And he considers teaching what he knows, and he kind of comes to the conclusion, you know, I don't think anyone will get it. I don't think I'm going to bother. These are the words from the suttas. He thinks, I guess, enough with teaching the Dhamma, or the truth, that even I found hard to reach, for it will never be understood by those who live in lust and hate. If I were to teach the Dhamma and others would not understand me, that would be wearisome and troubling for me. So, fortunately, in the story, there's a Brahma who is a god existing in a Brahma realm, wise, compassionate being who, through some means, knows what the Buddha's thinking and says, so, his name is Brahma Sahampati. So Brahma Sahampati considers, the world will be lost since the mind of the perfectly enlightened one inclines to inaction rather than action. And then he appears before the Buddha and says, Lord, let the Blessed One teach, let you teach, let the Blessed One teach the Dharma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes. There will be those who understand. Which I think is quite something, because Sahampati comes and says, you know what? You're wrong. And fortunately for us, the Buddha then agreed that this may be the case, and he would teach. And then Sahampati makes a statement, open are the doors to the deathless. The deathless is another way for nirvana or nibbana, freedom, enlightenment. So when I consider the story of the Buddha's awakening, it seemed that the Buddha had gotten the wisdom part of this bird with two wings, but wasn't finished yet until he considered, and who knows if this Brahma was really part of his own consciousness that came to fruition, that then the compassion aspect blossomed and completed his awakening. So compassion arose, I think, when he viewed the world and saw, oh, the amount of suffering that was in the world, and that he was moved then to help. So just like in the story of the Buddha's awakening, we see that compassion arises when we are in touch with or connected to or turned towards suffering, our own suffering or the suffering of the world. Just put the clock here to keep track of the time. So here's a quiz. What was his first teaching? What was the first teaching that the Buddha gave then after this decision to go and teach? I don't know. Anybody other than Eric? asked, what was his first teaching?
Life and suffering.
What's that?
First noble truth, life and suffering.
Yes, yeah. Well, to make it more complete, he didn't leave it there. He actually taught the four noble truths. He taught the bad news and the good news. So he taught the four noble truths to the people he had practiced with earlier. So that was his very first teaching. And to me, that was his compassionate action, was this teaching that he gave on the four noble truths. And I just wanted to look at that. You were talking about the first noble truth. I might just change the wording a little bit. As opposed to life is suffering, it sounds pretty dismal that there is part of life is suffering, or there is suffering in our life, or unsatisfactoriness. First noble truth. It's like going to the doctor, and he says, "What's the problem?" And, well, that's the presenting condition. In the Four Noble Truths, that it sometimes it's viewed as kind of a medical kind of diagnosis, is that there, what's the problem? So there is suffering in life. What's the cause of the problem? The cause is attachment. And what is the cure? Well, to let go. Non-attachment. And then the fourth noble truth, those are the first three, the fourth noble truth is the path that leads to being able to let go, which is sometimes called the Eightfold Path. I just wanted to look at the first truth, though, which talks about that there is suffering in this world. We will experience this. It might be called unsatisfactoriness in this human existence. And that just means that we won't just experience pleasant things throughout our life. We will experience a balance of pleasant and painful, and that is part of our human experience. But there's in his teaching on this first noble truth, he doesn't just stop there. He doesn't just say there is suffering in this life. There's another instruction that he says, and this suffering is to be understood. And to me, that's a really key part of this teaching. Ajahn Chah, who's in the Thai Forest tradition, he has a great way with words. So he says, okay, there's two kinds of suffering. There's the kind of suffering that leads to more suffering, and there's the kind of suffering that leads to the end of suffering. And I think what he's really saying is it's not really that there's two kinds of suffering, but there's two responses to suffering. So I just made a little list. Well, what sorts of things lead to more suffering? And my little list is certainly not complete, but things like aversion or self-hatred, guilt, the sense we are not enough or the sense we don't have enough. When we respond to life with greed, aversion, or delusion, this leads to more suffering. And what's the suffering which leads to the end of suffering? Well, I think it's the response of turning towards and understanding suffering, opening our hearts, having a compassionate response, can transform suffering into a path which leads to the end of suffering. So I just wanted to talk now a little bit about the cultivation of this quality of compassion. So just look at different things that support this quality. I've spoken a bit about Ajahn Chah. When Ajahn Chah taught in Thailand most of his life, he did make he made a trip to the West, and he visited. He had some monks in England and America, and he came and visited and did some teaching. So he made this something he noticed. He said, you know, in Thailand, people start, when they're growing up, they practice things like generosity and ethical conduct, for example, the five precepts. And after they have that as a foundation, they may practice meditation. Now, in the West, people do it backwards. People seem attracted to, oh, well, learning about meditation, and then maybe as an afterthought, oh, what are these five precepts? Oh, what about generosity? That's not really part of our culture to have that at the front of our thinking. So Ajahn Chah also said, practicing generosity cleanses our hearts of selfishness. Our minds grow in compassion and caring toward all living beings. So I already mentioned something like paying attention to the precepts and an intention to not harm through our actions, having the intention of not harming. There's a good book on compassion by Christina Feldman, and I thought I might just read something from her. So I presume this is in Asia. She, as a young woman, traveled to Asia. When I first began to practice meditation, I turned up eagerly for the first session with my teacher, anticipating that I would be introduced to esoteric practices and initiations, sounds Tibetan. I was disappointed and somewhat insulted, particularly when my teacher told me that I was not mature enough to meditate. Instead, I was instructed for the first months to spend hours each day reflecting on my motivation, contemplating cause and effect and interconnectedness, and nurturing compassion. Although I was reluctant to admit it, my motivation for wanting to meditate was extraordinarily self-centered. I was searching for transcendental experiences, self-improvement, basically looking for a way to maximize my own happiness and decrease my personal pain. In the eyes of my teacher, the only authentic reason to practice meditation was to bring about the end of suffering, wherever it existed, through wisdom and compassion. So it talks about appreciation and gratitude was one of the things she would practice and reflect on. And I'm thinking of that first line from Thich Nhat Hanh's Gatha of waking up this morning, I smile. And I wonder if one way of interpreting that is kind of appreciating being alive today. Appreciating being in this human form and being alive. So another kind of foundational piece for compassion is mindfulness. And mindfulness, compassion will only take place right now in the present moment. It doesn't take place, we don't create it in the past, we don't create it in the future, but we create it right now. So our simple willingness to show up, to be present, and to show up for all of life. Here's a little story. Jack Kornfield likes this story. So it's called Love Begins in the Smallest Ways. During my second month of nursing school, our professor gave us a pop quiz. I was a conscientious student and had breezed through the questions until I read the last one. What is the first name of the woman who cleans the school? Surely this was some kind of joke. I had seen the cleaning woman several times. She was tall, dark-haired, a woman in her 50s. But how would I know her name? I handed in my paper, leaving the last question blank. Before class ended, one student asked if the last question would count towards our quiz grade. Absolutely, said the professor. In your careers, you will meet many people. All are significant. They deserve your attention and care, even if all you do is smile and say hello. I've never forgotten that lesson. Her name was Dorothy. So mindfulness and being present for others as well. It's actually a great example of, in some of the guided meditations, I talked about the neutral person, the person we don't know who we might extend kind wishes towards. And in that case, I can quite imagine that Dorothy, the neutral person, became a friend. Actually, the neutral person doesn't necessarily stay a neutral person when we get to know them. So one, another quality that supports compassion is patience. Some of you might be familiar. There's a cartoon, and it appears to be Zen monks, two Zen monks in their meditation hall. And it seems like there's the old guy and then the brand new monk. And one would think from what's just taken place that the young monk has kind of said, okay, so what's next? What's next? What's next? And the older monk in the caption kind of says, well, this is it. This is all there is. There is nothing next. This is it. Somebody who talks about patience a lot is the Dalai Lama. And he also talks about impatience as well. One of the things it seems that he has worked with. My experiences are nothing special, just ordinary human ones. Through my Buddhist training, however, I have learned something about compassion and developing a good heart. And that experience has proved very helpful in my day-to-day life. For example, the region of Tibet that I come from is called Amdo, and the people usually regard people who come from Amdo as short-tempered. So in Tibet, when someone would lose his or her temper, people would often take it as a sign that the person is from Amdo. However, when I compare my temperament now to the way it was when I was, say, between the ages of 15 and 20, I see a noticeable difference. These days, I hardly find myself being irritated at all. Even when I am, it doesn't last long. This is a marvelous benefit of my own practice and training. Now I am always quite cheerful. You can kind of hear him saying that, right? Here's what he says about starting this practice of developing compassion. We should begin by removing the greatest hindrance to compassion, anger and hatred. As we all know, these extremely powerful emotions can overwhelm our minds. Nevertheless, despite their power, anger and hatred can be controlled. If we don't control them, these negative emotions will plague us with no extra effort on their part and impede our quest for the happiness of a loving mind. And he goes on to say about compassion, compassion is by nature gentle, peaceful, and soft, but it is also very powerful. It gives us inner strength and allows us to be patient. It is those who easily lose their patience who are insecure and unstable. Thus, to me, the arousal of anger is usually a direct sign of weakness, whereas he would think that responsive compassion is more powerful. And here's a quote from the Tao Te Ching, the Taoist teachings. I have just three things to teach: simplicity, patience, and compassion. These three are your greatest treasures. Simple in actions and in thoughts, you return to the source of being. Patient with both friends and enemies, you accord with the way things are. Compassionate toward yourself, you reconcile all beings in the world. So the next area I'd just like to talk about is compassion in the face of adversity. And this might be great adversity, or like the adversity of me meeting these guys on the street. Here's thought this was interesting. So this is Ajahn Suchito, who's a student of Ajahn Chah. He's from England. A few years ago, a friend of mine, let's call him Steve, drove his delivery van into a petrol station to fill the tank. The man who was operating the pumps, a young man like Steve, leaned into the car and noticed the photograph of Ajahn Chah pasted to the dashboard. So this would be someone in robes. He came up with some jeering questions as to who this bald guy in robes was and why did my friend have such a weirdo pasted up to look at. Steve was taken aback at being mocked, but held his ground. So he just responded with truth. He explained to the young tough that before reading Ajahn Chah's teachings and meeting his disciples, he'd felt depressed at how meaningless life seemed. He hadn't known what to do with his life. He felt lonely and was just wasting his time, sometimes even felt like ending it all. But before he could get much further, the other, this young tough guy, interrupted with, "You mean you feel like that too?" So. So good for him. Good for Steve. Of course, there's people who have experienced much more extreme adversity. This is a book by someone who's on death row in San Quentin, who decided that he did not want to die with anger in his heart and became a meditator in prison and has a Tibetan teacher. So talk about a place to practice. This is a book of kind of short thoughts and stories from this extraordinary man's life. So in the story, he's in one cell, and a new guy gets put in the next cell, and the new guy is in quite a state. He wants a cigarette. And I think it's he can just feel the energy, and it's just this guy next to him. But this fellow's name's Jarvis J. Masters. So Jarvis J. Masters would get up early in the morning, very early, just kind of before things get going in the prison, and roll up his blanket and do the best he could at practicing meditation. But there's some cell further down, somebody has lit up a cigarette, and this guy beside him smells it, and he starts banging on the wall, and the whole thing is shaking, just saying, "Give me a cigarette. I need a cigarette. And when you get halfway done, give me that cigarette." So, anyway, the fellow's name seemed to be Boss Hog, his neighbor. And Jarvis J., he kept a few things. Jarvis J. did not smoke, but he kept some tobacco and a few things that he would share. And so he decided, I'll read a little bit from this. So he kind of says, "Okay, wait a minute. I think I can find you a bit of tobacco and some rolling papers," I told him. "But you have to stay cool and not go disturbing the peace on the tier again," I added. "Will you give me your word?" There was a long silence. To me, this meant Boss Hog was taking his word seriously. This made him a rare bird. Few new prisoners took even a second before saying anything for a free cigarette. "Yeah, man," he finally answered. "You drive a hard bargain, but you got a deal. I'll keep it all on cool, my word, man." I looked around my cell for something to wrap the tobacco in. I had a photocopy of Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Being Peace, that a friend had mailed me. Later he had received another book of the actual book, Being Peace by Thich Nhat Hanh. So he had all these sheets of paper of the photocopied version. So he wrapped up the tobacco and the paper in this page from Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Being Peace. And they managed a way, they call it fish lines, and they managed a way to get it over there. "Oh, this is cool, really cool." Over the next few months, I kept sending Boss a daily supply of tobacco, always wrapped in a page of Being Peace. Boss was still a bit off his rocker, but I began to consider him a kind of brother. One page at a time, he came to like Thich Nhat Hanh. Every now and then, Boss even tried his best to meditate, but he was never able to stay awake early in the morning. As he put it, "To go on some old meditation trip with you, Jay." After 18 months, Boss Hogg was released from the grip of San Quentin and from dependence on me for tobacco and being peace. Before he walked off the tier, he stood in front of my cell, and together we recited what had become Boss's mantra, something he'd learned to say whenever he was about to blow his top. We always started off chanting in unison with the words, "Man, man," and then, "If we are peaceful, if we are happy, we can smile. And everyone in our family, our entire society, will benefit from our peace." It's pretty amazing to just think where this was taking place. And that is possible. And of course, we have capacities for good and evil in our hearts. But I think it is great to reflect on the good that is possible. And I think it is useful if there is someone or something that inspires you to just reflect on that, or in developing this quality. You can hang out with people who you think have that quality, or reflect on others. So has anyone heard of Alice Hertzsommer? I'd seen her written about a couple of times in the last few months. So she's the oldest living, she died last month. She was the oldest living survivor of the Holocaust, of a concentration camp. So, and the first article I read was that someone had made a short documentary about her, about this amazing lady. And it was up for an Academy Award, and I believe it actually won the short documentary. And then a little while later, I saw her obituary, which I have saved, I've cut out, and I'll put it somewhere. Maybe before you go, just have a look at the picture of this lady. 110 years old. And very bright eyes, beautiful smile, very positive attitude, despite incredible challenges in her life. She grew up in Prague, Jewish, born in 1903. Her mother was taken away. She was a piano player, and her mother's last instructions to her when she was being taken to for transit to a concentration camp, the mother was going away, and she said, "Learn Chopin's Etudes." So, like, any piano players here, like, know the anybody play Chopin's Etudes? Anyway, these are incredibly different. I'm not a piano player, but from what I understand, these are incredibly difficult etudes to master, and she put all her energy into this, and she actually then she had a son and husband, and they all then, about a year later, went to a camp. And in this camp, there was actually music. There was concerts where she performed, and that kept her going and seemed to keep her and her son alive. Her son actually did perform as well, but her husband was sent off to another camp. So music. So there was this little bit of beauty in this horrible situation that kept her going. So later, she and her son immigrated to Israel, and she seemed to know different people. This is a very modest woman. She became a piano teacher, and she did some performing. And she would have little concerts in the afternoon in her small apartment with her piano, and little social gatherings. And one day, Golda Meir shows up early. And this is before Golda Meir became the prime minister of Israel. But Alice Hertzsommer is in the kitchen peeling potatoes and for soup for this gathering. And Golda Meir says, "Oh, I love peeling potatoes. Sorry you came early, but I love like preparations." And so Golda Meir asked her, this is about her religion. And she said, "Well, I am Jewish, but Beethoven is my religion." And I just saw a little clip on a little promo for this movie. It was like 8 seconds long or something. You can imagine this feisty kind of German-accented woman speaking English saying, "I never hate, I'll never hate. Hatred breeds only hatred." That's actually, the Buddha might have said that too. Doesn't matter where it came from, it's true. I'll just read a couple of more things from her. "I love people, all kinds of people. I love to talk with people. I don't look at people as a group to be judged. Behind every man and woman is a story. I am interested in learning about the best in each individual." Which sounds to me like a bodhisattva. "Alice never tires of pointing out we are responsible for our actions and our words. And each of us must vigilantly guard against prejudice and hatred in our own minds and with the words that fall from our lips. No one is exempt, no one. Hatred only begets hatred." "We are nature. God is nature. Impossible to believe I am 107 years old. You know that I am very independent and have the freedom to think for myself. I am so very happy that I woke up today." So I think for me it's kind of inspiring to think that this is possible. For people to face these challenges and come through. I'd had another heading here called forgiveness, but it seemed like forgiveness and compassion in the face of adversity kind of blended together. They're part of, I think about Nelson Mandela. And him saying, "Courageous people do not feel forgiving, do not fear forgiving for the sake of peace. Courageous people do not fear forgiving for the sake of peace." And then Archbishop Desmond Tutu said, "Suffering can embitter and it can ennoble." Explained Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who presided over the Truth and Reconciliation Committee at Mr. Mandela's request. We were very fortunate that in Madiba's, that's his family name, in Madiba it did the latter. It ennobled, because you have forgotten. Madiba went to jail an angry, militant young man, quite rightly upset at the travesty of justice that he had experienced with his comrades. And the 27 years in prison were quite crucial in helping him to mellow. For example, Nelson Mandela learned the Afrikaans language so he could converse with his jailers. And this is what he said after gaining freedom after 27 years of imprisonment. "I knew if I didn't leave my bitterness and hatred behind, I'd still be in prison. And resentment is like drinking poison and then hoping it will kill your enemies." And one thing I've thought about forgiveness is perhaps another way of viewing forgiveness is not providing a place for anger to reside and hatred to reside in our heart. So if we go back to the two wings of the bird, compassion and wisdom, and thinking about equanimity, there's something called the eight worldly winds in the Buddhist teachings. Here's a quote from the Dhammapada: "Praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute are the eight worldly winds. They ceaselessly change. As a mountain is unshaken by the wind, so the heart of a wise person is unmoved by all the changes on this earth." And just would like to tell just a little story from happened to me quite some time ago. And just as an example, some of these stories are like, wow, these people, how would I ever even approach anything like that in terms of wisdom, compassion? But I think compassionate action can be all kinds of things, simple things, things that happen in our daily lives. And I remember at a point in my life, I was feeling very, it was a difficult time, both emotionally, and as it happened, I had a very bad cold at the same time, and I was flying. I was living in Toronto at the time, and I was had some difficult relationships, things happening. So I was feeling very low, and also physically as well. And I remember I was changing planes in Chicago, and beside me was sitting an older African American man. And I was just kind of sitting there, just kind of barely, kind of existing with this cold and kind of feelings that I had throughout the flight. And then I was getting off to change planes to go to Toronto. And so I hadn't spoken with him at all. So I was suffering. And I remember getting up and getting my bag. And he stood up and he just said, I forget the exact words that he said, but he extended his hand and basically said, I wish you well on your journey. Or he might have said, God bless you. I don't really remember what he said, but it was just a simple gesture that he made that I still, decades later, remember, and that brings warmth to my heart. And imagine that's a very simple occurrence that any of us could make. And it's good to remember, to being on the receiving end and being able to accept that, and also to practice that too. And what I would take from what his gesture and what he said was, you know, I recognize your suffering and I care about it, something like that. So I'll just end with another few more words from Thich Nhat Hanh. Look at the flowers, butterflies, trees, and children with the eyes of compassion. This is a deep practice. The energy of compassion in you will transform life and make it more beautiful. Compassion is always born of understanding, and understanding is the result of looking deeply. Compassion is always born of understanding, and understanding is the result of looking deeply. So I see that compassion is what connects us. So maybe we'll just take a moment and just settle with those words and thoughts. What we're going to do now is a little ceremony with these names, offering compassion, caring,